In a brave move, doctors in Malaysia walked off the job on the 26th of July, the first doctor strike in that country in almost 40 years. That's not an easy thing to do. Malaysia prohibits public employees, including doctors, from joining unions. Doctors were threatened with arrest or sacking. But in fighting against unfair and punitive contracts, they were pointing a way forward for all Malaysian workers suffering under the regime of Prime Minister Mahathir Yassin. Today I'm talking to two Malaysian activists. Aisyah Huzaini is an activist based in Kuala Lumpur, and Jason Wong is a Malaysian student studying in Melbourne and a member of Solidarity. You're listening to The Sound of Solidarity, brought to you by Solidarity, a revolutionary socialist group in Australia. If you'd like to find out more about us, our website is solidarity.net.au. I'm David Glanz, and I'm recording this episode on unceded Wurundjeri land in Nam, or Melbourne. Aisha, welcome.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
No worries. Now, first up, what were the issues that led to the strike? Because a strike is a serious business.
The strike was organized by contract doctors or junior doctors. And this issue, I guess from an outsider's perspective, it seems like it came out of nowhere. But this issue has been just simmering under the surface for the past 5 years, and it really boiled over in the form of this strike. The formal demands from the doctors were that they wanted to have a clear pathway to permanency and also opportunities to specialize, to become trained in further specialized fields of medicine.
Why were they angry? What was the treatment that doctors had experienced that led them to take this step?
They're truly the backbone of the Malaysian healthcare system. I wasn't aware of this until the strike, but about 45% of doctors in Malaysia are actually contract workers. And, you know, in the moment that we are in terms of COVID, they're really just being overworked and underpaid.
Is there a pathway for junior doctors to get permanency? Is that part of the problem?
So something they've said recently is that even if you ask like the Ministry of Health what is the pathway to permanency, they don't think the minister would have an answer, because they're really, it's not something that they planned for when they introduced the contract system. They just introduced it and were like, hope this works out. And they never really had a plan for their doctors to make them permanent, to make them specialized. And so many doctors have been resigning in the past few months, stating that they don't have any hope for their future in the field of medicine.
We'll come back to the organising of the strike in a moment, but do you want to tell us a little bit more about the health system in Malaysia and how it copes generally and how it's coping now with increasing numbers of COVID cases?
With regards to public healthcare in Malaysia, it's free. Jason, please correct me if I'm wrong. It's free or it's very, very cheap. And so because of this, I believe that they handle like 75% of admissions, like 75% of cases in the whole country. But they're cracking under the underfunding of hospitals, but also the contract doctors being squeezed dry. And they also only have 10% of the country's specialists. But so you can imagine that disparity between 10% of specialists having to handle 75% of admissions, like it's not a system that will be or is sustainable.
And what is the situation with COVID in Malaysia at the moment?
It is, frankly, not good. So we breached 5-digit cases earlier this month, about 8th July, I believe. So we hit 11,000 cases on the 8th. Today and the past few days, we've consistently been seeing 17,000 cases per day. And every day, I think it's about 1,000 patients being admitted to ICU. So it's kind of bleak. And obviously, this made it more difficult for the public to find sympathy in the striking doctors, because they were like, okay, we might come back later to this, David, but, you know, saying that we're selfish to do a strike now, why can't we just protest peacefully later, all of that.
Jason, perhaps we'll bring you in here. As I said in the introduction, public sector employees, including doctors, are not able to join unions. So the strike presumably was organised outside of conventional structures. How did the doctors go about organising the walk-offs?
The doctors come in through a housemanship placement as a cohort, and they become quite close to the cohort that they're with at the same hospital where they're placed. So that's where it tends to start. So they've got chat groups within each hospital, and more generally, there's an understanding that because they're under the same terms of a study program and government contract, that they link up with each other on that basis. So the impetus for the strike itself happened back in April and May, when the Malaysian Medical Association, which was looking at the skyrocketing COVID cases, basically asked the government whether or not they would consider reforming the contract doctor system, which Aisha was talking about. It's been in place for 5 years. Essentially, the situation was that while the government technically is supposed to use these graduating cohorts to staff the public healthcare system, effectively since 2016, when the contract system was implemented, only about 700 or so of a total of 23,000 graduates produced by the entire medical training system in the country have been offered permanent positions. And the health minister essentially responded to the Malaysian Medical Association's open letter by saying, no, we're not going to do it, and by defending their current system. And the doctors were essentially incensed by this and decided that after 5 years of attempting to negotiate more intake, that they would have to take some action.
Is there much sympathy for them amongst other health workers, nurses and other hospital staff? Or are they being seen as a bit privileged?
To be honest, it's a little difficult to tell. Amongst nurses and pharmacists, for example, we know there's a great deal of support. There's been blanket support within the front-facing bits of the health sector. Because on the day we saw, for example, senior doctors stepping in to cover the shifts that the doctors were leaving behind, there were nurses who spoke anonymously in support. But it's difficult to gauge because, for the most part, the doctors themselves are the wing of the healthcare system that is least able to be criticized. Everyone else below them is really, really precarious. And for example, if you consider auxiliary health workers like hospital cleaners, they're for the most part quite low income and quite precarious, quite contractualized, and there's a significant migrant workforce. So it's practically impossible for them to, display open public solidarity without getting in serious trouble. There's actually been an instance of that because last year, a bunch of hospital cleaners in Ipoh, which is a smaller city, went on strike against union busting, and they were basically all arrested under COVID restriction laws.
And how many doctors, we're talking about a doctor strike, it can be big, it can be little. Going on the photos I've seen, it clearly took place in many areas. How many people were involved and what was the nature of the strike? This wasn't an open-ended action, was it?
This wasn't an open action, it's a preliminary strike. So it's important to remember in this case that the doctors have never really done an industrial action before. As you say, they're not allowed to unionize, so they've essentially gone off of a Facebook group and whatever advice they've been able to cobble together from friendly unionists overseas that have done this before, or people who have gone to train in the UK, for example, in the medical field and were observing the strikes there in 2015. The strike itself had participation from, the press estimates, about 1,000 to 2,000 doctors. The actual number is unclear because each hospital was striking for its own, on its own plan. So the actual strike itself involved doctors basically walking off the job for anywhere between 5 to 30 minutes, and the doctors had declared to the public that this was their intention because we're in a pandemic and they didn't want to risk public backlash from quote unquote abandoning their patients and violating the Hippocratic Oath. So the strike itself was quite short. It was a walk off. They only went outside the hospital, held up some signs for the press, took interviews. They arranged as well for senior doctors to cover their shifts wherever that was possible.
What was the media reaction? And insofar as you can measure it, presumably through social media, what was the broader public reaction to this action?
It seems quite positive. I haven't really seen much criticism except from the government itself.
I think actually, the funny thing was that there were a lot of, government, whatever, ministers also mildly, vaguely supporting the strike. Maybe we can avoid that. But in terms of public reaction, I think from what I saw, like the Facebook Live videos of like news outlets recording, streaming the strikes, the reactions were mostly positive. I don't think there were very many trolls.
The positive reaction, Aisha, is obviously really heartening. Does that tell us something about the general situation for working people in Malaysia? Have living standards gone up or down? Is life harder now than it was, say, 5 years ago?
Life has just gotten worse under COVID. I think it's hard to explain how close to poverty or how deeply poor most Malaysians are, that the divide is huge. And I think some people do understand. I think a lot of the sympathy comes from the fact that these are frontliners. Jason, we might touch on the Lawan protests yesterday, and I think those garnered much less sympathy. But as doctors, they've made it very clear that we don't want your clapping or your murals dedicated to us. We want to be treated fairly and compensated for our work that we do for the country. They've made it clear that all of this is for the people. They're not striking for themselves. So I think that really led to an outpouring of public support. I think also the people also see themselves in the doctors in terms of being desperate and knowing that this is like a last ditch resort. It wasn't striking for fun. This is like, we've tried everything and we're just going to do this because it's the only thing, we have nothing left to lose.
The situation's been deteriorating in Malaysia for quite a while. Malaysia has one of the poorest working hours to income ratio in the amongst middle and high income countries. We work a lot and we don't earn very much. So to give you a picture, when the Pakatan reformist government took over in the elections in 2018, the historic elections that toppled the previous long-standing government, people were mobilizing to increase the minimum wage. And there was pushback from the government for that. And there were studies conducted that said, for example, in the Kuala Lumpur metropolitan area, a quote-unquote living wage for a starting family was somewhere around 2,700 Malaysian ringgit per month. And the minimum wage at the time was only about 1,000 ringgit per month. And it went up slightly to 1,100 after significant public pressure. But that's sort of where the general working class is at. And the doctors themselves, at least the starting contract doctors, are not immune to this. So the contract doctors have released their pay schedules whilst they were arguing for one of their demands, which was pay parity with the beginning level of permanent doctors who essentially perform the same duties as them. They're about anywhere between 500 to 900 ringgit per month short of their permanent colleagues, despite doing the very same work. And that means they're taking home somewhere around 2,500 ringgit per month, which, as you will remember, is lower than the living wage. So that essentially means that if you live in a major metropolitan area in Malaysia and you have spent all this money, often in a private medical training college, you don't make enough to get by.
And how true of that is that of workers in general?
It's probably true for everyone who isn't, you know, a manager, I would have to say. Casualization is rife. A lot of people are dependent in some way on the gig economy. So we've actually had one or two gig economy strikes. So there were food delivery driver strikes and parcel delivery driver strikes during the pandemic. There was one instance where, for example, during a parcel delivery strike, that was triggered by a subcontractor outright refusing to pay their employees wages on time. And the drivers essentially had to resort to threatening and in some cases following through on the threat of destroying packages in order to force the company to pay up, right? And that's not to say anything about rampant labor abuses in factories, in particular against migrant workers who have been basically assaulted on all sides during the course of this pandemic. Yeah, like it's difficult for me to quantify the concrete situation simply because the union movement is so weak and we don't hear very much in the way of concrete statistics. But as pertains to the general situation, part of the outpouring of support for the doctors has also come out of something called the Black Flag Movement. Sort of around the same time as the doctors were preparing to organize this strike, there was the Secretary Solidarity Rakyat, which I imagine we'll get to later, because they're also organizing actions in this space, called a Twitter action, essentially, declaring that the government had failed to look after the people's needs during the pandemic, and to put up flags, a white flag if they required aid, and a black flag as a sign of protest against the government's failures. So lots of black flags and white flags started going up there, and basically that was the first time that the country, which had been under lockdown, collectively understood the scale of the destitution that the labouring class is going through under this pandemic.
How do people see the government of Mahiuddin Yassin? He's declared a state of emergency. Is that just a health emergency, or is that something more insidious? Is that more of an attack on civil liberties?
So the entire way that Muhyiddin or Mahiuddin came to power was illegitimate. Last year in March, there was a government form, and he just stumbled into the prime ministership. And the first emergency, I think, was declared October last year. And I think even by then, it was very transparently a move to, you know, clamp down on dissent, a move to hold on to his power. And as cases kept getting worse during the emergency, people did see that even though Mahiuddin claimed that this was, you know, for purposes, it was to deal with COVID. It wasn't doing anything. This authoritarianism is not a public health response. So at this moment, people are just really fed up with the emergency and how the incompetence of this government that leads to, you know, deaths every day and more cases every day.
And is there any kind of resistance on the streets, or is this at the moment passive and social media type resistance?
So I think for the entirety of last year, it was fully just online protests. When there were crackdowns on migrant workers, that was fully online. So it wasn't really proportional, I think, to the scale of the problem that people were responding to. But in the past few weeks, SSR, Secretary of Solidarity, right yet, they've really been pushing for in-person actions. So I think a few weeks ago or a week ago, there was a car convoy like across the country with the black flags, with the hashtag Lawan. And even though like it's a car convoy, it's like the safest form of protest I could think of. But I think many of the organizers were called in for questioning and compounded. And then yesterday, which I think Jason will touch on later also, there was a call to protest on the streets of Kuala Lumpur, obviously. So we thought this would have less participants because it's impossible to travel from different districts. But yesterday was incredible in the energy and the response. From the video that I could tell, there were about 2,000 people who came, all wearing black, all bringing flags and placards demanding that Mahiuddin resign.
That sounds great. Lawan means resist, I understand. And perhaps tell us a little bit more about the Secretariat Solidarity Rakyat, which I've obviously mispronounced, but it's the Secretariat of People's Solidarity, SSR. Who are these people? Are they long-term activists? Is it a new formation?
So SSR was fairly recent May that they were cobbled together from various activist groups. And from what one of the founders said, they formed because they wanted to do politics and activism without the partisanship. Like they were trying to as many people as possible, and they kept kind of assured. Jason, I might be super wrong about this. This was like a Twitter space a few days ago, and I can't remember what Dharma said, but they don't want people to think they're partisan, like they're for one political party or the other, like, which isn't to say they're not being political, because they are, but I think they just don't want the baggage of being called socialist or DAP, which is a party. or opposition or whatever. They just want to be people driven.
And you mentioned socialists. There is a socialist party in Malaysia. I know that none of the left groups or left tendencies are very strong, but has the left been able to, the socialist left, been able to play a role in these campaigns?
Yeah. So, well, first of all, your pronunciation was actually pretty good. So good job there. The socialists have been able to plug themselves into this movement because the Secretary Solidarity Rakyat is, you can think of it as an alliance of previously existing some of the smaller radical NGOs, activist groups, activist collectives and the like, basically coming together. So a lot of these people are seasoned activists of some description, but there's also some new blood that's particularly arisen over the course of the last year or two. Like Instagram activism has become very, 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 very prevalent in Malaysia, partly because it's really the only form of activism that isn't going to get you called in by the cops at some point, for the most part. Yeah, the PSM, which is Parti Socialist Malaysia, the Malaysian Socialist Party, has been a part of the SSR from the start. They've been doing a lot of the outreach and media for this. I do want to mention as well, just to give a bit of context, like in Malaysia, the word partisan implies affiliation with a formal political party. It doesn't imply centrism or neutrality, right? So the SSR is overwhelmingly leftist in its composition and nature. They haven't gotten to, you know, promulgating like super left demands for the moment, because the entire activist left in Malaysia has basically been searching over the course of the last year for something that will galvanize people enough that they're willing to get off the internet and take to the streets in a COVID safe way to protest the government. And it turns out that all they had to do was wait for the government's own incompetence to get people killed for that anger to come about. So you got murmurs last year, for example, when this third wave began, and it's worth stating for context for an international audience, like you'll hear that Malaysia is undergoing a third wave. This third wave is almost entirely artificial in creation. So we had a state election last year. There was fallout from the coup that took place in February that influenced one of the states, and they had an election. And Mahathir in his great wisdom decided that he would not allow postal ballots in this election, which means that he and all the other politicians and all their posses had to fly over to the state of Sabah in East Malaysia to campaign, where there was an ongoing cluster, and residents of Sabah all had to get on a plane and fly over there in order to vote and then come back. And when everyone came back, the politicians, in particular the ones in the ruling government, flagrantly violated the quarantine restrictions, and they released the virus into their respective constituencies. And that was the beginning of the third wave. So that's what eventually prompted Mahathir to announce this emergency in January, essentially because at that point, his coalition was falling apart. One of the major component parties, UMNO, the United Malay Nationals or National Organization, which is a right-wing, ethno-nationalist, Malay-first party, had basically been pointing in the direction of, okay, we'll support you guys temporarily, but when the election comes, you're on your own. So essentially, he'd lost solid coalition support, which is one of the things that triggered him calling the emergency in January this year, basically to say, well, if you guys can't come to parliament, then you can't hold a vote of no confidence, and I get to be prime minister for a couple more months. That was the thinking. So there were calls by SSR, Secretary of Solidarity Rakyat, to reopen parliament when this happened. And there were flash mobs, there were small protest actions outside of parliament by these activists to demand that. As per usual, they were called in for questioning. And then SSR forms formally shortly after that, when the activists decide that a concerted organizing effort is necessary to bring out a crowd that's more than just the usual activists.
You mentioned ethno-nationalism. A significant factor in maintaining the conservative status quo in Malaysia is playing ethnic groups off against each other, Malays against Chinese, against Indians. Has what's been happening in recent months, both the crisis and the stirrings of resistance, has that led to a lessening in those ethnic tensions, or is the government really encouraging and boosting ethnic division?
That's a really interesting question. I wouldn't say that it's resulted in a lessening so much as it's resulted in a temporary absence. So here's the thing. For the most part, this ethno-nationalism is quite obviously promulgated from above, right? There aren't, for example, in, like you see in a lot of Western countries, relatively independent groupings of people who organize around racist policies. And the government itself, it resorts to the racism in order to win elections. But every coalition, every major party also concedes that Malaysia is a multicultural country. So they know they can't lean into it too heavily. So what's happened is that since the emergency, so from the period of February up to when the coup happened, up until roughly around October, November, when restrictions began to clamp down, Parliament was still going, and there was still a by-election contest going on. That's one of the side effects of having a political system that's really hostile to young people, is that you get a lot of old people going into Parliament and then croaking in the middle of their terms. So we had literally five by-elections in that time frame, and that was a really key thing for UMNO and a lot of the other right-wing parties. So the main players in this case are UMNO, which I've mentioned earlier, which is the long-time government. They've ruled since 1957, with the exception of 2 years, 2018, 2019. They've been in government. Bersatu is another party. That's the party that Muhyiddin belongs to. Very long story. It was essentially a split engineered from UMNO, but yeah, that's a whole other podcast. But Bersatu is politically identical to UMNO, with some very minor exceptions. And then there's BAS, which is a conservative Islamist party. This is the sort of coalition that they've got going right now. And there's a bunch of smaller, like, East Malaysian parties, but they're so small that they essentially have to be parasitic on whatever the ruling coalition is at the time. So this coalition typically promulgates its racism by interjecting into, like, political questions on the ground, parliamentary debates, by elections, and basically blaming all the problems that crop up on any Chinese or Indian politicians that happen to be involved. But the irony of the lockdown means that they haven't been able to do that. So over the course of 2020, in these five by-elections, three of them were won by the conservatives on a purely racist basis. Like, if you read the papers about the debates that were taking place for that seat, you would, and I'm not exaggerating here, you would literally see that their single line of campaigning going into these regions was that they would tell the non-Malays that they're better at administering the country, which is a blatant lie. And they would go and tell the Malays that their policy platform was simply to ensure that there would never be another Lim Guan Eng. So Lim Guan Eng is a Chinese finance minister who was in the previous reformist government. So they would basically point to the previous government and say, we had a Chinese finance minister and an Indian attorney general, and everything went to hell. And when we, the conservatives, go into government, that's never going to happen. That was literally their campaign line. And they won three of the five elections based on that. I suspect that the reality is more to do with disillusionment in the performance of the current government, and people simply wanting to choose whatever alternative there happened to be. Better the devil you know. But under conditions of lockdown and no parliament running, they haven't actually been able to get onto national television and mouth off on those things. So the country's more or less been focused on the actual, well, destitution and poverty that people are experiencing. So instead of hearing about politicians saying really stupid things on the TV, with a few exceptions, we can get to those later. It's basically been COVID cases are going up, the emergency isn't doing anything, people are running out of food, there's not enough vaccines to go around, Europe isn't accepting Sinovac, yada yada yada. So in a strange way, the emergency has actually temporarily reduced the amount of racism in public discourse, but it hasn't resulted in any commensurate advance for anti-racist politics. Nobody's talking about race, which is very unusual for Malaysia, because that's all we talk about normally.
Okay, this has been really fascinating. And as you've suggested, there's probably more than one podcast to come out of some of these issues. But to begin to draw things to a close, what are the next steps? The doctors, I assume, have not yet won their struggle. Workers more generally are suffering in the way that you've outlined. The SSR is on the streets in larger numbers than obviously has been the case for a little while. What can we look forward to over coming weeks and months? And is there anything in Australia that we can do to assist the struggle?
So with regards to the doctors, they are coming together and discussing whether they want to form a formal union. Not one like the MMA or Shomos or whatever, like a real workers' union. Another thing is that they've threatened a second strike if their demands are not addressed by the time the budget is tabled. And I think that's October 29th, which is kind of a ways away. We'll be ready for that. And if they're willing, or if they think they have the strength to go on an indefinite strike, or like a longer strike than the previous one, then I think it would be pertinent to support them materially, like strike funds, all of that. Also, we talked about this before, but it was difficult, I guess, to gauge how the participation was. And I think for the strike to really get what they've to really win their demands, it would have to spread more, not just to like all of the contract doctors, but also to the nurses, the pharmacists, the hospital queens, like everyone who works in a hospital has to link up, or should link up, and recognize that this is the same struggle. This is all the same healthcare system that they are fighting for. So I think that would be all that I can think of right now for the Hartal. About Lawan, Jason, do you have anything?
Hartal is a sort of word for strike, while Lawan is a word for resist or resistance.
That's right. The situation is really in the balance at the moment. There's a great deal of potential. So obviously, like in the past month, we've seen more resistance to this government than we've seen pretty much since the beginning of the pandemic. And that's been precipitated by the government's own incompetence. Like, people are watching the case numbers break records pretty much daily. Today's a record. I think we're on, 17,000 new cases today. The other thing that's happened to sort of shake the government is that this week on Monday, the parliament was forced to sit again because the king, who technically has the ability to call these sorts of things, I think caved to public pressure. They'll never admit it, but the king caved to public pressure and decided to call the parliamentarians back for a special sitting to deliberate on the emergency measures themselves. And what the government essentially did was lift the emergency ordinances retroactively before the parliament session began, so they could not be debated and then put to a vote and then defeated. But that is technically against rules of procedure, and the king is involved, which means that this can be easily interpreted as the prime minister basically going behind the king's back, which is an absolute no-no in conservative circles. So there's a huge uproar there as well, saying that the current government is a traitor to the king. So there's a conservative basis for the backlash as well, unfortunately. But that means that the government's on really shaky ground, and they're really looking to sort of just ride this out. The strategy at the moment appears to be, so they've closed parliament on Monday due to giving the excuse that there's been a few COVID cases detected. And it looks like their strategy is simply going to be able to ride it out until October, when the vaccination numbers look a little bit better and people can stop attacking the government for that and try and take credit for it. So that means that for the doctors and for the Lawan movement, that it's going to be a period of consolidation. So the doctors themselves are very much aware of this. They're in talks about how they would form a union. And I'm not sure what sort of avenues they're deciding to take, because that is, as we mentioned earlier, extremely illegal in their particular case. Then they're also looking to consolidate their base. So, you know, there were hospitals where the doctors were intimidated by the police into calling off their strike. And then there's always the question of, okay, how do we continue taking these sorts of industrial actions without hurting critically in need patients? So there's that need to broaden the strike. So the left is busy trying to form links between the doctors, who are the most politically insulated class of protesters, I think, in Malaysia at the moment, with other more vulnerable groups of nurses, pharmacists, and the like. And for the Lawan movement, I think we can expect in the near future more police harassment. So we've had a quiet but actually unprecedented announcement from the police yesterday. So there weren't mass arrests during the protest yesterday, which is actually quite unusual. Normally, the cops try to arrest somebody on the protest. They didn't do that this time, possibly cognizant of the massive public support that the Lawan movement has. So they're going to try and wait for it to die down before calling people for investigations and probably nailing them on whatever phony charges they can come up with that way. And that means that for the Lawan movement, it's going to have to take advantage of this lull while the government is on the back foot to push forward. There's a great deal of emphasis now on like the procedural stuff, right? So the PM going behind the king, and folks on the left are constantly trying to push the angle like we don't particularly care that some procedural trick has happened. What we care about is that people have died, and that there's no policy to help poor. The handouts and emergency payments have ceased for the most part. All manner of stuff I could go on about. So for what we can do from here, I think is to just keep an eye on the movement. I can't really think of any direct, for example, union links that might be at play here, but something might crop up eventually. But there is a small but active community of diaspora Malaysians that would be switched onto this sort of thing. So, for example, we here in Melbourne, we run a small outfit called Malaysian Progressives in Australia, MPOZ. If you want to look that up on our socials, you'll be able to stay up to date with solidarity actions that are taking place in Australia. For the most part, that takes the form of photo actions. It may escalate.
Just about the activist not being arrested yesterday, I think it also could be the fact that the day before the event, one of the organizers was arrested for planning the event and inciting violence or whatever. And there was more public sympathy than for previous arrests or compounds or whatever, because she's a 20-year-old kid who was arrested over a social media post, and she was in lockup for 10 hours. So I think the insanity of the treating activists at the moment, I think also had the police hold off on arresting people on the spot.
And they went to that activist through their family, through their mother and aunt, which is really messed up. And like, speaking as an activist, in this sort of family context, is actually one of the more effective strategies you can come up with.
On that note, I'll thank you both for your time, Aisha and Jason. And of course, we send our solidarity to the doctors in their continuing struggle, to the SSR, to the PSM, and everyone else in Malaysia who's standing up against the spread of COVID, against poverty, and against repression. So thank you for joining us today.